This episode is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. At Lockheed Martin, veterans are at the center of everything they do. In fact, one in five of their employees has served in uniform. Lockheed Martin is proud to help men and women like you successfully transition into civilian careers. Join Lockheed Martin and you will find opportunities to take on the same kind of long-term, challenging assignments you tackled while in the military. Whether you're on active duty, transitioning, or already embarking on your civilian career, Lockheed Martin's Military Connect is your online community for professional support. You can find out more at lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. That's lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans thrive in their career transition and in their civilian career. Today is episode number 225 with Mark Mitchell.
One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that every Special Forces team that went in that first wave carried with it a part of the World Trade Center that our commander, then Colonel John Mulholland, now Lieutenant General, retired, had procured from a friend in New York City, and we carried him in with instructions to bury him at a place where we had inflicted a defeat either on the Taliban or Al-Qaeda in an appropriate ceremony, and we did that and recorded a 10-digit grid coordinate. We then reported those back up to the task force headquarters, and it was eventually printed on a full-color map of Afghanistan. With some photos and appropriate labeling that was printed out and framed and presented to the New York Police Department, the Fire Department, the Port Authority. And I had the privilege of personally delivering one to the 9/11 and World Trade Center Museum when I was the 5th Group Commander.
Well, if you've seen the movie 12 Strong or read the book Horse Soldiers, you know a little bit about Mark's work. Both in the military and out of it, Mark has played a pivotal role in our country's defense. In this interview, we talk about his work in special operations immediately after September 11th, as well as his career since his military service as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict. Mark works with a $13 billion budget and a 70,000-person team. This is a great interview for those of you looking to learn about government contracting roles or becoming a senior executive service government employee, or for those of you looking to hear us for some incredible military stories. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find links to over 220 episodes just like this one, as well as links to our coaching program where you can get subsidized one-on-one career and executive coaching with our team. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Mark. Well, joining me today in the Pentagon, mere feet away from the Secretary of Defense, is Mark Mitchell. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Justin. Thank you.
I wanted to give listeners a very abbreviated version of your bio. Mark is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict at the Office of the Secretary of Defense. For those of you who have read the book Horse Soldiers or seen the movie 12 Strong, you'll be familiar with some of Mark's incredible work. Mark started his career in the U.S. Army, where he served for over 28 years, most recently as a colonel. Mark was among the first U.S. soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan after 9/11 and advised the Northern Alliance prior to the fall of the Taliban regime. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for his actions in the November 2000 battle of, and forgive my mispronunciation here, Kala-e-Jangi and Mazar-e-Sharif. So, Mark, maybe to start things off, I'm sure that many of our listeners were in college or high school or maybe even middle or elementary school when 9/11 happened, and you were in such a prominent place at the time. Could you describe what it was like to serve in the invasion of Afghanistan?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I want to take it back just a little bit, though, to the first 10 days of September, because it was really interesting. I had just come out of Special Forces Company Command in 3rd Battalion, 5th Special Forces Group, and I was now the battalion S3 operations officer. And my commander had directed me to plan a multi-state unconventional warfare exercise in the western United States that would involve going on horseback, working with local resistance forces, all the types of things that we do in special forces. And so from the 1st to the 10th of September, I'd been out there going all the way from Utah up to Wyoming and looking at different sites and planning this exercise. And this September 11th was actually my first day back to work after 10 days of TDY. And I recall my morning routine, do PT, and then go over to the what we used to call in 5th Group, the Desert Inn, our dining facility, and had when I walked in, one of the planes had already struck the World Trade Center, and within probably 5 minutes of me sitting down, the second plane struck, and it was clear to me immediately that whatever was going on, 5th Group would probably be involved. And sure enough, for the next 4 or 5 weeks, every day was a duty day, planning, prepping, waiting on word for exactly what was going to happen. And I finally, we started flowing over there in mid-October, and then near the end of October, I got the notice, say, go over. And honestly, I wasn't anticipating ended up behind enemy lines. As a Battalion 3, I thought I'd be setting up an op center. And, next thing I know, I was told, hey, you're in isolation, you're planning to go in, and we're going to advise Abdul Rashid Dostum. So after several days of planning and several days of failed attempts due to weather, to get in, we landed after about a 3.5 hour flight in MH-47 helicopters at a small landing zone, LZ Burrow, in the heart of Afghanistan, about 150 kilometers south of Mazar-i-Sharif. And it was surreal. All of our training had prepared us for that, but yet as an officer who came, went through his training in the mid 80s, came into the Army at the height of the Reagan buildup, and spent, a good portion of his career, concerned about the Russian threat and, the Soviet Union. We were all very well aware of their experience in Afghanistan. And honestly, none of us ever thought that we would end up there. As background, I ended up on an ad hoc team that consisted of my Special Forces Company headquarters. So my command sergeant major, or my company sergeant major at the time, and my B team medics, my B team combo guys. So it was kind of like just going back a few months. But I remember waking up that first morning and watching the sunrise after a pretty tense night, and all kind of wondering what was happening. And then that very first day, meeting up with General Dostum and trying to build rapport with his guys. Now, we had, ODA 595 had preceded us in and had linked up with him already, but still there was a lot of work to be done. And my Sergeant Major and I just kept looking at each other going, this is just like Robin Sage, which was the culmination exercise for the Special Forces Qualification Course. And, the scenarios that we encountered were right out of that. And anyway, it was an exhilarating and at the same time terrifying experience. But we were none of us would have traded. There was nothing that could have made us want to be anywhere else but right there, serving our country, helping to bring justice to those who planned and facilitated and carried out the attacks on 9/11. And to be a part of that historic operation. And it was a huge privilege. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that every Special Forces team that went in that first wave carried with it a part of the World Trade Center that our commander, then Colonel John Mulholland, now Lieutenant General, retired, had procured from a friend in New York City. And we carried him in with instructions to bury him at a place where we had inflicted a defeat either on the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. in an appropriate ceremony, and we did that and recorded a 10-digit grid coordinate. We then reported those back up to the task force headquarters, and it was eventually printed on a full-color map of Afghanistan with some photos and appropriate labeling that was printed out and framed and presented to the New York Police Department, the Fire Department, the Port Authority, and I had the privilege of personally delivering one to the 9/11 and World Trade Center Museum when I was the 5th Group Commander. In retrospect, you know, it was a tremendous privilege to have the opportunity to serve there, and to, you know, to be able to come home, tell about it, and look back at it. It's hard to believe it's been 17 years.
That's so incredible. I have never heard that about the piece of the World Trade Center. I think that's such a beautiful ceremony. It must have been powerful to take part in that. And then I love the symbolism of bringing those maps to NYPD and the fire departments and just all of those people affected, and attempting to give them some semblance of sense of closure or some sense that progress had been made. And it's just incredible hearing your story too. I can only imagine how frightening and how intense it must have been to be in that environment immediately after 9/11. But I was just wrapping up at the Naval Academy at the time, and my sense from a lot of people was this sense of desire to be involved in some way, but not helplessness, but kind of a sense of like, what do we do? And so I imagine it was at least fulfilling and exhilarating to feel like you were taking action, that you weren't just waiting around, that you were actually doing something. That must have been a just amazing part of history to be a part of.
Yeah, it really was. And for all of us as Special Forces officers and NCOs, the opportunity to do exactly what we had trained for in a real world situation, you know, going behind enemy lines, working with resistance to overthrow a hostile regime, and it was every day was kind of like, wow, we're really in Afghanistan, and this is really, really happening. And then again, the tremendous progress and the rapid success that we enjoyed was also just really satisfying to see the Taliban being crushed before us with our Afghan allies and watching them. It was again a really an amazing and satisfying feeling that we had done something for the nation and for all of the victims there and everybody who suffered after 9/11. And again, I can only say it was a privilege and an honor to have been able to serve in that role.
It's also encouraging when you referenced the name of the training operation that you had gone through, and the real world circumstances reminded your colleague of that. It's I guess reassuring to me to think that, wow, like these trainings and eras that people have put together were actually good preparation for the actual thing. That's gotta feel good to know that you were going in feeling like this was what you had trained for and what you had been designed to do.
Yeah, it was, it's just so hard to describe when you find yourself, it's just deja vu. It's like, wow, I have been in this situation before. I'm trained for this. I know what I'm supposed to do. I can anticipate what's going to happen. And that in itself was really comforting. And a lot of the scenarios that we found ourselves in, and even the ones that where we hadn't, you know, that were uncertain, We had that confidence in our training that so much of it had mirrored that, that it carried over, and that we were confident that we were trained not what to think, but how to think in these situations and how to be successful. There were some surprises, mainly on our own side, in terms of some of the preparation So when you go into training, there's always some sort of there's necessary fictions that you just can't replicate, but you always assume that they're going to be there when the actual shooting starts. And there was a couple of things that, like, okay, really, we don't have this. We used it in training, but we don't. We planned for it in training, but we don't have it. And specifically, the ability to provide lethal assistance, weapons and ammunition to our counterparts. Thankfully, there was other people that had that capability, and we were able to leverage that. But it was, there were some great lessons learned. But fundamentally, our training was absolutely sound, and it gave us what we needed to succeed.
That's incredible. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your transition from the military. This is the 225th interview that I have done, and we always talk about the veterans' transition to their civilian career and any unexpected obstacles they face. But I'm just aware of everyone I've interviewed, your background in the military and the operations that you participated in. It's just such a unique experience. And so I was just curious if you faced any transition hardships or challenges as you switched from a military career to a civilian career.
There was, a couple of challenges. One was unique because my last duty assignment was the White House and the National Security Council in 2014. And I worked as a director for counterterrorism. And in my portfolio, I had the hostage, anything relating to terrorist hostages. And as most people will recall, 2014 was a seminal year in terms of international hostages, particularly with our American hostages, American citizens held by the Islamic State in Syria, most of whom were executed or tragically killed. And it was a very, very difficult and time-consuming year. The demands of working at the White House, for anybody that hasn't been there, can be extreme. And especially when, as a director, you have your portfolio, and there's really, you don't have a staff of your own. So when something needs to get done, you do it. And most days I was at my desk by 7 in the morning, and it was rare for me to leave before 9 p.m. at night. And I was in the office on Saturdays and Sundays, as were many of my colleagues in the CT directorate. It is a full-time, all-consuming job. So one of the challenges that I faced was simply finding time to plan. The working the NSC is an all-consuming job. I was normally at my desk from 7 in the morning till at least 9 o'clock at night. I worked up, weekends. And so when I scheduled the transition course over at Fort Myer, I ended up going to the transition course from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, and then going back to the NSC from 4 till about 11 each night. And really cut into your time, my time, to think about what I wanted to do, what was available out there. And so that, it was difficult in that I just did not have time to plan and to really give the type of thought and contemplation that should go into a transition. Now, luckily, we had already decided we weren't moving, so I was staying here in the Washington, D.C. area, so that took out one of the big variables. But the rest of it, what I wanted to do, and again, what was really available out there, especially as a special operator, one of the things that, one of our strengths is planning and international experience, leadership, management, all those types of things. But the flip side is going into the private sector, in a lot of cases, we lack, specific domain expertise, in a particular industry. And so you're kind of challenged to find one where you can jump in at an appropriate level, and still be able to contribute. And so, the challenge for me, the biggest challenge was finding time to plan. And what I've advised a lot of my friends and colleagues who are considering transition is to take a transition course. When you start thinking about it, maybe even 2 years out, sign up for it and go to it, and then take it again when you're closer to actually retiring or transitioning, because there's a lot of things that you just won't be thinking about based on your everyday duties and what's going on while you're on active duty. And so it triggers some thought processes that are critical, again, about what's available. What do you really want to do that's going to motivate you to get out of bed and be excited to go to work, not just simply to collect a paycheck? And that's, I think for a lot of folks, that's a challenge, because the private sector, even government work in the defense industry or contractor work is not the same as actually being in the arena or on the field. It's great to watch from the sidelines, but guys want to be in the game. And so I think that was a challenge for me. And I was at a fabulous company, great environment, but there were still times when I felt kind of unfulfilled, that I wasn't able to contribute in the same manner to our national security that I'd become accustomed to.
That's certainly a trend that's come up in a lot of these interviews, is just kind of no matter what you were doing in the military and what you do after the military, there's kind of the sense of maybe missing a sense of purpose or a sense of identity, and certainly a sense of connection to your brothers and sisters who served with you in the military. And one thing I wanted to just touch on briefly is, I'm only imagining what it must have been like working in such an intense environment in the White House, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. under very stressful circumstances. And I know that a lot of our guests have expressed questions and concerns about work-life balance in their civilian career. And I know you were still in the military at the time, but I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that balance and what that was like working at such a high tempo, and how you maintained a sense of sanity, and just any thoughts on advice for working in under extreme circumstances like that.
Well, so I will tell you, at the end, when I finally did leave the White House, I was grateful. I was blessed to be there. It's a real privilege to serve the office of the president, irrespective of who holds the office. And I was actually able to hold my retirement ceremony in the old executive office building overlooking the White House, which was a real privilege. But that year when I left, I was physically, emotionally, and psychologically exhausted. Thankfully, I had 90 days of terminal leave, and I took all of it and basically used it to kind of recover and rest. Get back into a PT program. The downside for me, I gained 30 pounds that year from a lack of sleep, high stress, poor diet habits, lack of exercise, and frankly, some alcohol consumption in the time when I wasn't at work. So it was really stressful. I would tell you that maintaining some semblance of work-life balance is essential, especially if you want to stay in a job for more than a year. The White House is one of those jobs where going in that it's going to demand a lot, but you look forward to the end. I liken it to Ranger School for all the Army guys out there. When you're in it, I was a winter ranger from January to March. It was cold, miserable, tired, hungry. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't think about quitting. I never did quit. I made it. And, you know, the further it was in my rearview mirror, the easier it was to laugh and joke about it and to be grateful that I stuck it out. I had much the same experience there at the National Security Council. Made some great friends. But again, if you don't make time for yourself, you're not going to be, in the end, you're not going to be any value to your organization, your family, your friends. And you really got to find that balance to the maximum extent possible. And I'm in a much better spot now that I've had, you know, a few years of that in my rearview mirror.
And I want to skip ahead just a little bit, but, you know, when I read your intro, I said your title is Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict at the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Could you explain that to listeners? Like, what does that mean? What does that translate to in terms of what you're doing now?
Sure. So we're part of the Undersecretary for Policy. In simple terms, think of it in comparing to a military service as the 357 of the civilian side of the department's leadership, the Office of Secretary of Defense. There's a Undersecretary for Intel, for personnel and readiness, acquisition and sustainment. There's the comptroller and the general counsel, and then there's research and engineering. So there's seven undersecretaries, and below them are the assistant secretaries. And so in policy, we have five assistant secretaries. There are two regional ones, one ISA, International Security Affairs. It has Europe, Africa, and South America. And then there is the international or Asian Pacific Security Affairs that has Asian Pacific, Central Asia, and there's three functional offices. The one I'm in, Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict, Strategy Plans and Capabilities, and then Homeland Defense and Global Security. So within the office of ASD Solek, and again, I'm the principal deputy to ASD Solek. He is a presidentially appointed, Senate-confirmed official. So I'm at the last level that doesn't require Senate confirmation. And we have responsibility for special operations and combating terrorism, stability and humanitarian affairs, which includes UN peacekeeping, global health engagement, disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, and everything that civilian casualties. And then we have our counter-narcotics and global threats, which is responsible for administering the Department of Defense's counter-drug program and counter-transnational organized crime efforts, which also includes other forms of illicit trafficking. We also have we own detainee policy for the Department of Defense. And so those are our policy functions. We're unique also within the Department of Defense and in OSD in that we also have a service secretary-like function for the special operations community. So the National Defense Authorization Act a few years back placed ASD Solek in the administrative chain of command between Commander U.S. SOCOM and the Secretary of Defense. And so what that means is we're responsible for all the Title 10 functions, man, train, equip, type functions for the special operations enterprise. And that enterprise has grown dramatically since 9/11. We're over 70,000 people and going to about 72,000 across U.S. SOCOM. Our budget is north of $13 billion on an annual basis. And, you know, we have global operations. So we have a very large role there in helping administer that that portfolio. So you can think of ASD Solek, again, with a service secretary-like hat, and the commander of U.S. SOCOM, when he has his Title 10 hat on, as the service chief for the SOF enterprise. again, we're not a separate service. We still rely on the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force for a lot of our, for all of our service common stuff and for our personnel. But anything that's soft unique, we're responsible for. And just to give a quick example, the budget, that $13 billion budget, pays for soft unique training and equipment and operations. So the Air Force Special Operations Command has MC-130s. The basic C-130 is provided by the Air Force, and then we use the we call P-11, Major Force Program 11, soft peculiar funding to transform it into a special operations version, and it funds all of our training. So it's a very diverse portfolio. We jokingly refer to it as the junk drawer of OSD policy. When people don't know where to put things, they first response is SOLIC. And so it's a very broad portfolio. Really touches on the entire special operations spectrum and irregular warfare and then the service secretary stuff. So anyway, I as the principal deputy at ASD SOLIC, essentially like his undersecretary, and help him administer this massive portfolio.
It's just hard to even comprehend the scale of what you're doing at $13 billion annual budget and 70,000 person team. Is just that's just unbelievable. I know a lot of our listeners appreciate just the nitty gritty granular detail, and to the extent to which you can talk about this, I'd love if you could just walk us through a representative day. I'm sure no day is typical, but just kind of what your day looks like and what sort of things that you're doing throughout the day, just to paint a picture for our listeners.
Sure. Thankfully, my day here normally starts about 8 o'clock with an intelligence briefing. We have a executive intelligence briefers from the DIA that will come each morning and give us an update on the latest intelligence. And that usually takes 20 to 30 minutes. And then after that, the day begins in earnest. A lot of interagency coordination, working with our colleagues at the White House and preparing our leadership, whether it's the ASD or the Undersecretary for Policy or the Secretary himself, for interagency engagements, foreign travel, putting together read-ahead packages. And at my level, I'm generally reviewing, we have our staff, our action officers, they will put those together. I'll spend time reviewing those prior to giving them to the next level. Do a lot of external meetings with our foreign counterparts. For example, have a meeting with our United Kingdom counterparts to discuss, detainee issues and our detainee policy. Meeting with our Singaporean counterparts to discuss cooperation in counterterrorism, and or have a meeting at the State Department to discuss various efforts. And so the day for me typically consists of a lot of meetings and a lot of reviewing, particularly at the end of the day, as all of the packages come in that are due, whether it's letters to Congress or packages, briefing packages for high level that we put together, again, reviewing all of those. And we do quite a bit of interaction with our colleagues in the legislative branch, very frequently up on the Hill, providing classified briefings on latest efforts in our various areas of our portfolio, keeping them up to date on our plans and any legislative issues that we might have, and also doing open testimony for the secretary, or for ASD, goes up every year for posture hearings, which are open hearings, with the commander of USSOCOM. So It's a there's never a dull day here. I rarely have a lot of free space on my calendar. Thankfully, we've got a good team supporting us up here, and like I said, never a dull day.
Steve Bain from Beyond the Uniform helped set up this interview, and I'm just now even more in awe of the fact that he was able to get me on your schedule, given the extent of the things that you're doing. And I just imagine everything is so booked. I'm even more appreciative of your taking the time to connect with us in the audience today.
It's my honor. You know, one of the things I did when I got out, my CEO at Intelligent Waves, Jared Shepard, himself a veteran, a former Army infantry sergeant, who's now 43. He's a multimillionaire and is running a great company, Intelligent Waves. He also, out of his own pocket, started a company, a nonprofit called Warriors Ethos, dedicated to principally helping wounded men and women make that transition to the from the military and successfully transition new careers. And I was privileged to be a part of that effort. And from where I sit, I'm always happy to help, my comrades, colleagues, and other service members make that transition. It's a really important effort that frankly gets underlooked by most people until they're right on the verge of it. And so if I can be of any assistance or inspire people, I'm always happy to do that.
That's incredible. And for listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes to Warriors Ethos so you can check that out. I'm wondering if someone listening aspires to transition either into government contracting roles or pursue becoming a senior executive service government employee, what advice do you have for them about pursuing that as a career path?
It's a great career path. Even if you don't get in as a senior executive right away, there are opportunities to basically get promoted into the senior executive service. I have a friend and colleague who I worked with previously. He started out as a contractor in one of our offices, got hired as a GS-13, eventually worked his way up to GS-15, and he's now an SES. And he's a retired sergeant major. So there's great opportunities. I think one of the challenges here that we certainly face within OSD is we've been under policy or under personnel caps. So it's much more difficult these days to get in, at least within OSD. There's opportunities probably out in other departments and agencies. But if you aspire to be an SES, I would start looking immediately at the ECQs, the executive core qualifications. Again, that's for career SESs if you want to do that. It's part of the application process. And there are some good coaches and consultants that can help you craft those to have a better chance of success. It's highly competitive, but it's also very rewarding. And again, even if you don't get selected as an SES, we have a lot of former military serving in GS positions. That's a great way to go. The GS-15 is effectively equivalent to a 06 position in the military. They're very much engaged in a day-to-day piece. On the contracting piece, I'll just tell you, you're involved, and it depends on where you're at in the particular contracting realm. As an executive at company headquarters, you're probably going to be a little bit more disconnected. As an actual contractor working on site somewhere, there's a lot of opportunities to really feel connected. I mean, some of our contractors are engaged in extremely important work. They're part of our team. We couldn't do what we do without them, and they contribute a great deal on a daily basis. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. Again, it's I would recommend spending a lot of time doing research, reading, job descriptions and position descriptions. It takes a while to translate and to kind of cut through a lot of the chaff and identify exactly what the job really entails. And the more you spend reading those and talking to people, the better sense you'll have of exactly what's available out there, and really help you make some informed decisions about what you want to do down the road.
This is great. Well, I know we're running out of time here, but I always like to leave the last question open-ended, which is there anything that we haven't covered today that you want to make sure that listeners know before we wrap up?
There are a lot of great organizations out there that seek to help veterans transition. Unfortunately, there's no like central clearinghouse, but I would encourage folks to reach out to them. I give a shout out to my dear friend Anne Marie Craig, who runs the Commit Foundation that links transitioning service members up with senior business executives to mentor them through. There's Your Grateful Nation, and there's a host of other ones, again, that are specifically designed to help you transition successfully to a new career after your time in uniform is done. And, the earlier you start looking at those and think about them, the better off you'll be in the long run.
Awesome. And for listeners, I'll add a link to the Commit Foundation, Your Grateful Nation as well. And I'll also, I had the privilege to interview Anne Marie about the Commit Foundation in episode 154. So I'll put a link there as well. It's an incredible organization and a great resource for veterans. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And I know your advice today is going to help a lot of people in the military and a lot of veterans. So thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
It's an honor and a privilege, Justin. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Uniform. There are over 200 free episodes at beyondtheuniform.io. They're classified by the industry of focus, the functional role the person plays, and more. Beyond the Uniform is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our Director of Outreach, responsible for sponsorship and guest episodes, is Steve Bain. Our Editor, responsible for the show notes and text transcripts for all episodes, is Kathleen Dillon. Our Data Analytics and Insights Advisor is Andrew Woolridge. If you are enjoying Beyond the Uniform, you can help us out by telling your veterans and friends in the military about this free resource. There is more information on the website about how you can sponsor an episode or donate to our program to help us grow the work that we're doing. Be sure to check out the coaching section of beyondtheuniform.io, where you can be paired with professional, subsidized coaches to help you figure out your next career move. You can sign up for our newsletter to be up to date on the latest happenings at Beyond the Uniform. And in each show notes section, there is a link to audible.com, which is providing a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. You get a free book of your choosing, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to subsidize the cost of the show, regardless of whether you continue with audible.com or not. Check that out and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep the feedback coming. Let me know what resources would help you in your career, and we'll do our best to make that happen. Take care, be safe, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career.